Good evening, my dear respected friends. I'd like to thank you for coming along this evening to hear a Bible-based address to the title, Russia's Ambitions Have Been Foretold by the Bible. Friends, the reading that our speaker has chosen for tonight is to be taken from Ezekiel chapter 38. So, friends, with that reading, we'll now call forward our speaker, Mr. Jamin Hunter, to deliver his remarks to the title, Russia's Ambitions Have Been Foretold by the Bible.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good evening, everybody, and thank you for coming out tonight to hear what we have to say on the subject of Russia. We believe the Bible tells us what the destiny of Russia will be, and perhaps that would be a slightly better wording. But because the Bible does provide a very clear and coherent message about Russia, about the future, the destiny of Russia. It tells us that Russia will be the head of a confederation of nations who will oppose Jesus Christ as a military power. Now, if you've looked at a bit of Bible prophecy before and a bit of a brief look at some of the prophecies in Daniel and Ezekiel and Revelation, you might have gotten the idea from prophecy that they're a bunch of incoherent and unlinked pictures with strange, incomprehensible images and symbols. Prophecy does involve a lot of symbology, and it can be difficult to understand. But what we as Christadelphians find is when we look at what these symbols represent, how they're used elsewhere in the Bible, what they're actually speaking about, when we start to put these things together, we find that a lot of prophecies actually overlap, and we can piece things together and see that they start to form a coherent picture. They give us a coherent symbol, a coherent signal, sorry. They give us confidence that an interpretation of prophecy is correct and that these things will be fulfilled. And we'll see how that plays out in the prophecy of Ezekiel 38 tonight. But to start with, we're going to look at another prophecy from the book of Daniel, Daniel chapter 2. And we might turn there now because we'll spend some time in Daniel chapter 2. It's just over a few pages. You might know the story of Daniel chapter 2. Nebuchadnezzar, the king of the Babylonians, came and fought against the city of Jerusalem and took the Jews captive into Babylon. And among those captives was a young man named Daniel. And Daniel was to become one of the wise men, one of the advisors to the king of Babylon, to Nebuchadnezzar. Now, one night, Nebuchadnezzar had a dream. And as perhaps has happened to many of you, I know it certainly happened to me, when he awoke, he could vaguely remember the dream, but he couldn't remember exactly what it was all about. But it seemed to him to be very important. So he sent for his wise men, his astrologers and his soothsayers, and asked them, firstly, to tell him what the dream was, and secondly, to tell him what it meant. That's rather a tall order. And so, of course, the wise men and the astrologers and the soothsayers couldn't tell Nebuchadnezzar what the dream was, and so, of course, they weren't prepared to hazard any guesses as to what the meaning might be. But Daniel was a worshipper of the true God, who knows everything. And so, of course, Daniel knew that the interpretation of the dream belonged to God. And so Daniel prayed to God, and the interpretation and the dream were both revealed to him. And so he went in before Nebuchadnezzar the king to tell Nebuchadnezzar what the dream was and the interpretation. And so Daniel came before the king, and this is the dream that he described. There was an image standing somewhere. It doesn't specify, that's not important. But this image, it tells us, was very great. It looked very terrifying. And this image was made of a bunch of different materials. It was the image of a man, a statue of a great warrior. And its head was made of gold. It had chest and arms of silver. It had belly and thighs of brass. It had legs made of iron. And it had feet that were made partly of iron and partly of clay. Now, this image was standing upright, And suddenly a stone came onto the scene. It said the stone was cut out of a mountain without hands. And the stone struck the image on the feet and ground the image to powder, breaking it into pieces and grinding it small. And eventually that powder was blown away and the stone itself became a great mountain that filled the whole earth. So that was the dream of Nebuchadnezzar. So this was a prophetic dream. What's interesting about this chapter is, unlike a lot of prophecies, we're given the interpretation of the prophecy in the same chapter. Daniel interpreted the dream for the king, and he told Nebuchadnezzar that this dream was a prophecy, was a vision of what would come to pass in the future. And so we'll go through and see what the interpretation of this prophecy was. In verse 36 of Daniel chapter 2, he starts his interpretation and he says, "This is the dream, and we will tell the interpretation thereof before the king. Thou, O king, art a king of kings, for the God of heaven hath given thee a kingdom, power and strength and glory. And wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field and the fowls of the heaven hath he given into thine hand, and hath made thee ruler over them all. Thou art this head of gold. And after thee shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee, and another third kingdom of brass, which shall bear rule over all the earth." Now, just stopping at that point, we can see very quickly what this prophecy is all about. These different metals, different sections of the image, represent different kingdoms. Daniel said to Nebuchadnezzar, "Thou art this head of gold." And so Nebuchadnezzar, of course, representing Babylon, his kingdom, that was the head of gold. And so after Babylon, it said, there would arise another kingdom inferior to thee. And of course, after Babylon went off the scene, well, another kingdom came on the scene. Really, the kingdom of the Persians, they overthrew Babylon in BC 536. And so that was the kingdom that succeeded the kingdom of Babylon. And it says that that kingdom would be inferior to thee, and the Persians were inferior to the Babylonians in a sense. Daniel's just extolled the might of Nebuchadnezzar and how he was an absolute autocrat. The kings of the Persians weren't autocrats. They were bound by their own laws. So whereas Nebuchadnezzar, as king of the Babylonians, could make any law and break any law that he liked, the Persians had to abide by their own sayings. And so in that sense, the Persian kings were inferior to the Babylonian kings. So that was the first two. The head of gold was Babylon, and the chest and arms of silver was the Persian kingdom. The third one, another third kingdom of brass, which shall bear rule over all the earth. Well, the kingdom that succeeded the Persians was the Grecians. It was Alexander the Great who conquered Persia in BC 334, and thus his empire was the successor. And you'll notice it says in verse 39, he shall bear rule over all the earth. And well, Alexander the Great is famous even today for having a very expansive empire. He conquered what at the time was the entire known world. It said that he wept because there was no worlds left to conquer. And so that was the third kingdom, the belly and thighs of brass, the Grecians. So the fourth one, well, the kingdom that succeeded the Grecians was the Romans. The Roman Empire didn't suddenly come on the scene and kick the Grecians out, as happened with the Persians and the Babylonians. This was a more gradual transition. The Romans gradually expanded from the east and gradually became stronger, and they eventually overtook the Grecian states. In 146 BC, they decisively defeated a league of Grecian states, and so they became the sole Mediterranean superpower, and they would remain so for hundreds of years. They were known for their military prowess, and thus, as Daniel says in verse 40, "The fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, for as much as iron breaketh in pieces and subdueth all things." And the Romans were known for their military might. So that was the fourth kingdom, the legs of iron, the Romans. Then we come to the last one, the feet and toes of iron and clay. And we might ask, which empire succeeded the Romans on the world stage? It's actually interesting. There's quite a bit of debate about this historically, because there were quite a few empires who liked to think that they were the new Roman Empire. Perhaps it might have been the Ottoman Empire. Well, just a bit of history of the Roman Empire. It was at one point divided into the East and the Western Roman Empire. And the Western Roman Empire fell in AD 476. It more or less fell apart over a gradual period of time. And some people say it was 476 AD when it ended. Some people push that timeline out further for another couple of hundred years. The Eastern Roman Empire was the Byzantine Empire. And that continued to be the most powerful economic, cultural, and military force in Europe until the fall of Constantinople in 1453. And that fell to the Ottoman Empire. So was it the Ottoman Empire that was the feet and toes of iron and clay? Well, when we look into it, that doesn't seem very likely. For one thing, the Ottoman Empire never conquered Rome. But looking at what the prophecy actually says, it says in verse 41, "And whereas thou sawest the feet and toes, part of potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided, but there shall be in it of the strength of the iron, for as much as thou sawest the iron mixed with miry clay." And so what this tells us is that this final kingdom, the feet and toes of iron and clay, would be made from the divisions, the fragments of the Roman Empire. So how did that play out in history? How is it that the Roman Empire in some way would live on in this new empire of iron and clay? Well, the German legal theorist Rudolf von Gering once remarked that ancient Rome conquered the world three times. Conquered the world the first time through its armies, the second time through its religion, and the third time through its laws. And so although the Roman jurisdiction over territory, the Roman Empire per se, might not have continued, its religious system and its legal principles continued to live on after them. And where did that religious system and those legal principles live on? Well, it wasn't in the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire was Islamic. They had their own religious legal code. No, the Roman religious and legal principles lived on in the nations of Europe. There's the religion of Christianity. It's a Roman legacy and accounts for 72% of the population of the EU. And the majority of that, of course, is Roman Catholicism. Of course, the religion of the Eastern Roman Empire was the Eastern Orthodox religion, and, well, that is now the dominant religion in Russia and much of Eastern Europe. The legal system that applies across all of Europe, including Russia, but not including Britain, is known as the civil law. It's a system of laws known as civil law, and it's heavily based on Roman law. So much so that a knowledge of Roman law is considered, even today, indispensable for a law student in those countries. And if you are a law student studying law in those countries, more often than not, it's a mandatory subject in university that you study Roman law. Many of the languages of Europe today are closely linked to Latin, the language of the Romans. French and Spanish and Italian and Portuguese and Romanian, they're part of a language group known as the Romance languages. Romance, obviously, deriving from Roman. And those languages are descended directly from Latin. And so we believe that these feet and toes of iron and clay represent the nations of Europe in some way. We don't know whether at some point they will... We believe that at some point they will join together more cohesively to form an empire and so fulfil this image. So we wouldn't necessarily say that the nations of Europe today represent the feet and toes of iron and clay. They might do or they might not. All I'm saying is that's perhaps a point for debate. But it seems very clear that that is the general region where those feet and toes will be. So Daniel continued to go through his interpretation of this image. And he said that the stone would strike the image on the feet and destroy it. And that's in verse 44. He interprets that and he says, "And in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. And the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. For as much as thou sawest that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it brake in pieces the iron, the brass, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God hath made known to the king what shall come to pass hereafter, and the dream is certain, and the interpretation thereof sure. So this stone striking the image on the feet would be the God of heaven intervening, and after that he would set up a kingdom represented by the stone filling the whole earth. And so it seems that at the time of this final set of kings, the time of these feet and toes of iron and clay, God will intervene and God will destroy all of these kingdoms and set up his own kingdom, which will be over the whole earth. Now, when we're interpreting this prophecy, we need to keep in mind that it's a framework. It's not a detailed history. We can't fit every detail of history perfectly in and say, well, this is where this little event in history comes in this prophecy. That's not how it works. For instance, when you look at the Greeks, the belly and thighs of brass, you might say, well, that wasn't all one kingdom. There was Alexander the Great, and then there was the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. And that's a fair point, but it was all Grecian, and it's all a Greek period in history. And so while we can't fit every detail in, this is a very good framework for interpreting history. But the reason I say that is because there is a danger in this prophecy in getting too caught up in interpreting what the individual metals represent and saying the brass is this and the iron is this, and perhaps we can get a bit caught up in that and metaphorically lose sight of the wood because we're examining the trees. You see, this dream isn't about individual metals. This dream is about an image. It's about a statue in the shape of a man. We can see that if we go back to verse 31. Daniel says, "Thou, O king, sawest, and behold, a great image." Further on in verse 34, it says, "Thou sawest till that a stone was cut out without hands, which smote the image upon his feet." In verse 35, it says that this stone would crush the iron and the clay, the brass and the silver and the gold all together, all at the same time. So how does this work? How is it that all of these kingdoms get crushed at the same time? Aren't the metals all a succession of empires that existed at separate times down through history? Well, of course, that's true because that's how Daniel interprets it. But what we're forced to conclude is that the image, the dream showed this image as a coherent whole. And so we have to conclude that the prophecy gives us the key to identifying each of these kingdoms so that we can know what they were like and where they were located geographically. But they're used as a coherent whole, as a single image to show that at some point all of these kingdoms will be a confederation involving elements from all of the five kingdoms, and that confederation will stand up against God and be destroyed. And so that's really the main point that I want to bring out of this prophecy. This image of Daniel, this image that Nebuchadnezzar saw in a dream, this is a confederation of nations who would stand together to oppose God and would be defeated by God, be defeated by Jesus Christ at his return to the earth. So we might change gears here and say, what does Russia have to do with all of this? And that's where our reading for tonight comes in, Ezekiel chapter 38. Ezekiel 38 is quite similar in a way because it shows us a whole confederation of nations coming together, and it shows them being defeated by the forces of God. And so in verse 2 to 6, we have a list of the nations on one side of this battle. He says, "Son of man, set thy face against Gog, the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, and prophesy against him and say, Thus saith the Lord God, Behold, I am against thee, O Gog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal. And I will turn thee back and put hooks into thy jaws, and I will bring thee forth and all thine army, horses and horsemen, all of them clothed with all sorts of armour, even a great company with bucklers and shields, all of them handling swords, Persia, Ethiopia, and Libya with them, all of them with shield and helmet, Gomer and all his bands, the house of Tagama of the north quarters, and all his bands, and many people with thee. So that's the nations on one side of this battle, this confederacy of nations. And these are the ones who are destroyed by the forces of God, as we're told further on in the chapter. In verse 8, we're told that this confederation of nations would come against Israel. It says, "After many days thou shalt be visited. In the latter years thou shalt come into the land that is brought back from the sword and is gathered out of many people, against the mountains of Israel, which have been always waste, but it is brought forth out of the nations, and they shall dwell safely, all of them." So we've seen over the last 100 years or so that the nation of Israel has been brought back from dispersion around the world. They were dispersed throughout the nations of Europe, throughout the nations of America and Australia. But they've been, by and large, brought back into the land of Palestine and been made the nation of Israel again. And so these are the people that have been brought back from the sword and gathered out of many people. And this is the land that this confederacy comes against. And then in verse 13, we have details of the opposition to this confederacy, Sheba and Dedan and the merchants of Tarshish and so on and so forth. But the question is, who are these nations? Who do they represent? Well, we can start with verse 2. Because it seems like, it says, "Son of man, set thy face against Gog, the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal." So it seems that this Gog, whoever he is the leader of this confederacy. When we look at the Hebrew, Gog is actually a title. It means the one at the top. And so it seems that Gog is a specific person who will be at the head of all of these nations. Now, who are these nations? Well, look at verse 2. It says, "Gog, the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal." The chief prince. When we look at that in Hebrew, what we find is that the word chief should actually be a proper noun. It's the Hebrew word rosh. And so, as other translations have it, it should read, "Set your face against Gog, the land of Magog, the prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal." And there's other translations which are very similar to that. So we believe that should be a proper noun. And when we look at the historians, well, the historian Bocart says that Rosh is the most ancient form under which history makes mention of Russia. The Rosh, or Rus, were a Scythian nation bordering on the Taurus, answering initially to the territory of Ukraine, and then northwards to the steppes. There's other reasons that we could bring in support of that interpretation, reasons from history and reasons from geography, to support the idea that Rosh is Russia. We're not going to go into them tonight. We're not going to go into all of these nations in detail, but we can go through a similar process for all of them. We can look at the names that are given in Ezekiel 38 and find out their modern-day equivalents. So there's Gog and Magog, the prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal. And what we find is that they correspond to the nations of Russia and Eastern Europe in general. Then in verse 5, we have Persia. Well, Persia is the area of Iran and Iraq and Syria and Pakistan, that area around there. Then in verse 5, we have Ethiopia. Well, that's different to modern-day Ethiopia. It's actually the area of Kush or Sudan. In verse 5 again, Libya. Well, that's modern-day Libya. Hasn't changed. And Goma. That's an interesting one. Goma is the area of France and Western Europe. And then there's Tagama, which is the area around Georgia, Turkey. And so that is the confederacy of nations that comes down against Israel. And then we look at the nations opposing them. Well, of course, there's Israel. I don't imagine Israel would be on their side, seeing as they're coming against Israel. There's Sheba and Dedan, and those are ancient names for the nations of the Arabian Peninsula, the Gulf states. There's the merchants of Tarshish, and that, if we look at how else that is used throughout the Bible, that seems to represent the nation of Britain. And then there's the young lions of Tarshish, and, well, that represents the Commonwealth nations. They're not all on the map. only perhaps a section of India. The others are elsewhere in the world. So those are the nations that are mentioned in Ezekiel 38 broadly. But what I want to look at particularly is, if we go back to this map, the nations that are part of the Gog Confederacy that come down against Israel. What's interesting is that these areas are very similar areas to the areas that were occupied by the kingdoms in Daniel's image. There's the head of gold, which is Babylon. There's the chest and arms of silver, which is Persia. And they match up with the areas around Iran and Iraq and the northeast of Israel. There's the Grecian Empire. Well, that was the area of Greece and Turkey, primarily. There's the Roman Empire, which is most of this area here, including Italy and southern Europe. And, of course, the feet and toes of iron and clay, well, that's Europe, and that, of course, is there too. And so it seems that the prophecy in Ezekiel 38 matches up very well with the prophecy in Daniel chapter 2. And again, we see the key point. We've got a confederacy of nations standing against God, and this confederacy will be destroyed by the armies of God. And as in Daniel chapter 2, we see that this happens immediately prior to the setting up of the kingdom. We could keep on reading the next few chapters in the book of Ezekiel and see how that kingdom of God gets set up as Ezekiel prophesies. And of course, we're told in many other places in the Bible that Jesus Christ will be the ruler of this kingdom that is over the whole earth. And so we believe it will be Jesus Christ who intervenes in this battle, who destroys this Gogian confederacy. There's another point that's rather interesting to consider. If we look at the first four empires in Daniel's image, there's the gold, the silver, the brass, and the iron, the Babylonians, the Persians, the Grecians, and the Romans. Well, you can put the empires on a map. There's the Babylonians, and we'll overlay the Persians. These are the empires at their fullest extent, and I should say that, of course, the boundaries of any ancient empire are going to be somewhat fuzzy. That's the Grecians, and that's the Romans. What you can probably see is that there's a small section of territory that they all have in common, and so if we just take that small section of territory that all of these empires possessed at one point, we get this interesting shape here. Now, what happens if we put up the nations that are mentioned in Ezekiel 38 as being part of the Gogian Confederacy? We get this. And if we subtract that, we're left with that. So this is the one area that will not be possessed by those nations that are mentioned in the Gogian Confederacy. The one area that was possessed by all of those first four empires in Daniel's image, but is not part of those nations that are mentioned as the Gogian Confederacy. And so perhaps we can see it makes quite a lot of sense that these nations would be coming against Israel, because perhaps we could suggest that they would have to possess the land of Israel to truly be Daniel's image. If we look at all of the first four kingdoms that were mentioned in Daniel chapter 2, all of them occupied the land of Israel at some point, and all of them were involved in persecution and opposition to God's people. It was Babylon who destroyed Jerusalem and took its people into captivity for the first time. There was Persia, and during the Jewish exile, there was much sentiment against the Jewish people in the kingdom of Persia. The princes of Babylon in the time of the Persian Empire conspired to throw Daniel in the lion's den. And later on, Haman was an inveterate enemy of the Jews, and he attempted to exterminate them completely. There was the Grecians. Well, there was a chap called Antiochus Epiphanes, quite a nice chap. In the times of the Maccabees, he plundered Jerusalem, and he slew more than 40,000 people, and he sent nearly 80,000 into slavery. He forced the Jews to offer swine's flesh in the temple, a disgusting abomination to the Jewish way of life. And then there was the Romans. They committed countless persecutions of the Jewish people. They slew Peter, they slew Paul, they slew many of the other apostles, and they even slew Christ himself. They destroyed Jerusalem completely in AD 70 and sent its people into an exile from which they would not return for nearly 2,000 years. And so all of this would suggest that for the feet and toes, for the nations of Europe, and for all of this Gogian confederacy to truly become Daniel's image, they will need to invade and occupy the land of Israel. And that's just what Ezekiel 38 suggests. And so we can see that these prophecies start to present a coherent picture. They show us very similar ideas of what will happen in the future. We're not just limited to these two prophecies. There's other prophecies that we could look at, other prophecies which give us details of this battle, this confederacy. There's Ezekiel 38, which we've already looked at, Daniel chapter 11, Joel chapter 3, Zechariah 14, Revelation 16. And we'll look at a few details from each of those. There's one thing. All of those prophecies that I mentioned speak of a large number of nations who will be involved in this battle of Armageddon. It's Revelation 16 that actually calls it the battle of Armageddon, and it says that the kings of the earth and of the whole world will be gathered together to the battle of the great day of God Almighty. Zechariah 14 verse 2 says, I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle. Joel 3 verse 2, I will also gather all nations and will bring them down into the valley of Jehoshaphat. And of course, as we've just looked at in Ezekiel 38, there was a long list of nations that was given. Other common points between these prophecies. There would be a large number of nations involved, as we've seen. All of these nations would come to war against Israel, and that's a common theme through these prophecies. There will be an initial victory by the invaders whereby they will overtake the land of Israel. And that's another common theme in these prophecies. And of course, there's the intervention and victory by the armies of God, and that is a common theme running through these prophecies. And so what we can see, what I hope you're starting to realise, is that these prophecies are not incoherent with each other. When we put them together, they fit together and they start to present a coherent message, a clear signal about both history and the future. So what we can do now with the remainder of our talk is look at perhaps some of the events in the world, some recent events. But before we do so, of course, we should make a bit of a caveat with doing that. And I'm going to do so by looking at the analogy of a river. If you think about a river doesn't flow with any specific plan in mind. All that happens is that the water runs down a hill, and at every point it just flows in the direction that's easiest. And I guess you could say that history is very similar, because nations and politicians don't sort of flow necessarily. They just do what seems best to them at the time, and so it's really impossible to predict history just by looking at the events of the day. We can't say, well, this happened today, and therefore this will happen tomorrow. Of course we can say that, but 9 times out of 10 we'd be wrong. And so if we look here at the map of a river, specifically the Murray River in the eastern states, we think about the river as representing history, and prophecies are a map of this river. And now let's zoom in and look at a detailed portion of that river. Now let's think of this. It's very difficult to look at a very small section of the river and work out where that fits into the overall plan. We can't just look at this tiny little portion of river and fit that into the overall map. We have to look at quite a large section of river, and then we can start to piece things together and start to fit things into place. Now just imagine that you're standing on that particular bend of the river and looking down the river. And you've got this map of the river with you, printed out in your hands. And so you know where the river's going, and you know where the river's going to end up. But if you're standing on that bend of the river, can you predict where the river is going to go over the next 5 kilometres, or even over the next 100 metres? Well, of course you can't. And that's the same principle that we need to apply when we're applying current world events to Bible prophecy. because the prophecies tell us where history is going to end up. But the real world, day-to-day history, has a way of turning strange corners and doubling back on itself in ways that we would never expect. And so that's why we do not claim to know the personal ambitions of Russia's leadership or even Putin himself. Is he Gog? We don't know. He might be, but then again, he might not. Perhaps we could say a change of leadership in Russia would make Russia more likely to join forces with Europe. The point is, we simply don't know. And so with that caveat, let's look at a few of the longer term trends, a few longer stretches of river that seem to confirm where this river is going. Over the last 100 years, we've seen the return of the Jews to Palestine and the establishment of the land of Israel. That's something that's very clearly predicted by a lot of Bible prophecies, and we've seen it come to pass. There's a tension between Britain and the rest of Europe. Brexit and the ongoing tension around that are perhaps just a symptom of that. And Britain has been one of the chief helpers of Ukraine in the war against Russia. The rest of Europe hasn't been quite so keen. The rest of Europe buys most of their gas from Russia. And so they're rather limited in that regard. Before the war started, there was men like Emmanuel Macron, and they were starting to say that Europe should be trying to conciliate Russia for their mutual economic benefit. And even now, Mr. Macron is trying not to be too severe against Russia. We see growing ties between Russia and the nations that are northeast of Israel, especially Iran and Syria. Russia has supported the regime of Bashar al-Assad, and they've bonded with Ukraine over their common hatred of Americans. And that's especially been true since the war in Ukraine began. Both Russia and Iran have been heavily sanctioned by America, and so they've turned to each other to meet the needs of international trade and so developed bilateral economic ties. We've seen growing friendship between Arab and the Gulf states, and that's been happening under the surface to some degree for many years, since both Israel and many of the Gulf states are worried about the growing influence of Iran, and that's come into the open more recently with the Abraham Accords. And perhaps just on point number three there, one event in the past few weeks. Russia has promised dozens of Sukhoi Su-35 fighter jets. And they're going to be delivered to Iran. And these are quite advanced fighter jets. And the article makes the following comments. Iran will soon take delivery of a full squadron of Sukhoi Su-35 fighter jets from Russia. The development is likely to further enrage the West as Tehran and Moscow strengthen their defence and economic cooperation in defiance of broad sanctions and coercive measures. According to media reports citing military experts, Iran will soon receive 24 of the fourth-generation twin-engine super-manoeuvrable fighter jets that are primarily used for air superiority missions. It's quite a step up in capability for Iran, and perhaps just another sign of this ongoing deepening of friendship ties between Iran and Russia. But perhaps a counterpoint, what about the relations between Russia and Europe? They don't look so good at the moment, perhaps, but they're required to be on the same side by the prophecies of Daniel 2 and Ezekiel 38. And so we believe that that will change in the future. And perhaps we could speculate that if a leader came into power in Russia who was more prepared to conciliate Europe, well, certainly that conciliation would be in the economic interests of both. And perhaps that might happen rather quickly. And that's all speculation. As I said, we simply can't predict where history is going to go in the short term. All we can say for sure that this is what the Bible says. And so at some point in the future, the river will turn and Daniel's image will start to stand on its feet. So what's the significance of this for us? Well, we've seen throughout this lecture, the key point from these prophecies is that this confederacy of nations will be overthrown by the intervention of God and Jesus Christ. And he will set up a kingdom to reign over the whole earth forever. And the Bible elsewhere gives us a great promise that those who have been faithful to God and who have obeyed God in their lives will become a part of this kingdom, will be given immortal life and will rule over the earth with Christ. And that is our hope. And if you want to be part of that hope, then we urge you to look into these things for yourselves and see that the Bible provides a clear message for the future, and the Bible provides a wonderful hope, and that you could be a part of that if you so desire.
Thank you.